Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of Beyond the To-Do List, a podcast about productivity. I'm Eric Fisher, your host, as we discuss the true goal of productivity, living a more meaningful life. And that's exactly what we're talking about in this conversation with Michael Easter. He is a journalist and an author with books like The Comfort Crisis and more recently Scarcity Brain. And in this conversation, we're talking with him about his personal journey of overcoming alcoholism and that being a catalyst for him on a continued journey into how our brains are wired and why we make the decisions that we do when it comes to addiction and comfort and discomfort. And we're going to talk a lot about modern life convenience and how that's getting in the way of us actually making good decisions for ourselves. And I'm not just saying, hey, get off my lawn, or we used to walk to school uphill both ways and we had it harder, so we were better off for it. It goes much more beyond that. We're going to talk about his concept of scarcity brain and how it's about never feeling like we have enough despite having so much in the way of modern conveniences. We're going to also talk about social media and technology and how they end up being like slot machines wiring our brains in ways that make it hard for us to make good decisions. And when it comes to productivity, you want to be able to, one, have a strategic mind about it, two, make good decisions, and three, follow through. So this is going to aid in that thought process. If you've ever just felt like I'm distracted all the time, I'm always doing things I don't want to do when I know I should be doing other things that I should do, this episode is for you. So I'll get out of the way and just say, enjoy this conversation with Michael Easter. Well, this week, I am privileged to bring to you Michael Easter. Michael, welcome to Beyond the To-Do List.
Thanks for having me, man. This will be fun.
I'm really excited. And you've got a newer book out called Scarcity Brain, but you also are the author of The Comfort Crisis. And I couldn't help by looking at the two of them. Like, it looked like it was a 1-2 punch or a first salvo and then a sequel or a follow-up. And I wonder if you see it that way. Like, hey, here's the first intro, and then here, I'm going to double down.
So when I decided to write Scarcity Brain and was kind of centering on the concept after writing The Comfort Crisis, I didn't think the two books had anything to do with each other. I thought they were totally different. The deeper I got into Scarcity Brain, the more that I realized that they are similar themes, and they deal with similar concepts in the sense that The Comfort Crisis is about how we have engineered our world to be easier, more effortless, more comfortable. And while that is great, it's a part of progress, it also hurts our health, our productivity, our mindset in many different ways. And there's definitely some downsides to always doing the next most comfortable thing. So when I get into Scarcity Brain, it kind of looks at, you know, everyone knows everything is fine in moderation. Then the question is, okay, well, why the hell are we all so bad at it? Right? And it looks at how humans came up in these worlds of scarcity where everything we needed to survive and thrive was scarce and hard to find. And we have very recently, in grand scheme of time and space, tipped into abundance of all these things. And we don't have rails on that. And often, so the kind of overarching thing between the two books is like, you have to do slightly hard things in order to improve your life, whether that's choosing the uncomfortable thing in the form of exercise, or, you know, maybe I'm going to skip a meal. Maybe I'm going to sit with boredom and see where that takes me. Or it could be the hard thing of sort of resisting this world of more, more, more that we live in.
So I think some people would agree with you, but others, I think, are thinking, wait, you're saying we're more comfortable than ever. Why don't I feel like I'm comfortable? Like, I don't live or don't feel like I live in an abundant life. And I think you'd have an answer for that, right?
Yeah. So I'll refer to this part of the comfort crisis where I talk about this research that basically found as humans experience fewer and fewer problems over time, we don't become more satisfied. We simply look for the next problem. But as the world has gotten better, safer, more efficient in many ways, we don't realize it, right? We just find the next thing that we think is problematic, but it's not actually that big of a problem in the grand scheme of time and space. So your brain is always looking for the problem in your life. So you go, yeah, I'm not that comfortable. It's like, well, 100 years ago, we didn't have air conditioning. People didn't have cars. You had to go out and toil in a field for your food. It's like, if you put it in the context of 100 years ago, maybe you are more comfortable.
Yeah, actually, you said the word air conditioning, and I instantly thought back to, hey, wait a second. There was a long span of time when I was younger that we didn't have that in our house at all. We only had heat for the winter. And in the summers, it was fans in the windows and it was get outside. And honestly, as a kid, didn't care, didn't feel like it was that big of a deal. It was like, whatever. And growing up, though, you know, you get to like, I don't know, I'm trying to think of when it would have maybe kicked in, probably college or post-college. Oh, I gotta have some AC. And it's like this necessity when in fact it wasn't.
So generally, you can kind of think about it too as things that are luxuries today are going to become quote unquote necessities in the near future. And so as you kind of add more and more of these things that were luxuries, they become necessities. Once those things get removed, then people start to fret about them, even though before they were just like people appreciated things. So it kind of gives you insight into framing your problems in the grand scheme of time and space. So one of the things that I argue in the book is that when you look at what helps keep people happy, helps them accomplish more, helps them stay healthy, there's usually a buy-in that you have to go through discomfort to get the benefit. Right? So if you think of exercise, exercise is uncomfortable in the short term, but you get a long-term benefit. If you think of work or coming up with ideas or reaching a new sort of level in business, it's often you have to do a lot of work that is really hard and uncomfortable in the short term, but then you profit in the long term. If you do the easy thing, you're probably not coming up with a new idea that's going to move the dial downfield. Like, yeah, you might, it's good, you're doing something in the short term, but it's not really going to push the ball downfield that much more. And there's so many different areas of life where this applies to.
I think somebody out there saying, well, isn't this really just delayed gratification, but on a more nuanced, psychological, emotional, whatever you want to call it, scale? What do you say to that?
It is, but I think that, so I think there it is some form of a delayed gratification, but two things is that I don't think people realize how quickly our environments and worlds have changed to make things easier and more effortless. And how much material abundance we now live in when I think about the book Scarcity Brain. So, for example, even 100 years ago, people only owned 3 outfits, right? Now the average person owns 100. It used to be that the problem with food is that we didn't have enough of it. Now we throw out more than a third of the food in the U.S., and problems of too much food, the health problems from that are bigger than the problems of too little. So we don't realize how much our environments have changed. And then I also think that delayed gratification to a point, but that often gets translated into, oh, just do the hard thing. And it's like, well, no, we need to be more tactical about it. You know, it's how does a boxer improve at their craft? It's not by getting punched in the face, but as improving your craft as a boxer, you're going to have to take some punches in the face every now and then. So you have to make wise decisions about which type of gratification are we delaying. That makes sense. So getting tactical around that. And I think the books get into what are the things that people do need to be healthy, to be happy, to be productive, to sort of understand how the sort of evolutionary mechanisms that we have in our brain don't always work in our favor in the world we live in today. There's just a huge environmental mismatch in a lot of the problems we have.
Stepping back for just a second before moving forward, I want to go back a little bit and say, I'm assuming that maybe not an initial connection during the journey, but obviously maybe through the writing of the first and the second book now, your struggle and or battle with alcoholism in your early days, your past, probably set up some of the perspective or the mindset or even the catalyst for, in some ways, the path you were on to then write these books. Can you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, so, you know, how do you know if you have a drinking problem? And the answer is all of your problems are caused by your drinking. And that was totally me. And I had tried to quit drinking tons and tons of times, right? But I was always trying to find the easy way to drink less or to quit in a way that was going to be easy. And I think at a certain point, I just realized if I don't do something about this, I'm probably going to die early. You know, I didn't know if I was going to die in my whatever 40s, 60s, 80s. I just knew it would be earlier and that my life would also be less than it could be. And I realized that, you know, this probably shouldn't be easy to get over. And I was going to have to do this uncomfortable, hard thing of getting sober. And so the story of that is I really had to delay the instant gratification of alcohol, which is a great problem solver if you're a person like me, and go through just absolute physical and mental hell for a while. But on the other side of that, my life improved across the board. I mean, every single thing that you could measure, that you could not measure, it was all better. And at the time, I was working at Men's Health Magazine, and I noticed that every single thing that we covered in that magazine had that exact same story. It's that you had to go through short-term discomfort in order to get the long-term benefit. So that applies to exercise and improving your health. That implies to experiencing hunger if you wanted to, say, lose weight. That implies to improving your mental health if you have to have a hard conversation with another person or with yourself. So that sort of teed that up. And then I had ended up doing a story where I ended up spending like a week in the mountains hunting with this really interesting guy whose name is Donnie Vincent. And while I was out there, I experienced all these different forms of discomfort that I was going, what the hell am I doing up here? But when I get home, I felt far better. And I kind of realized the real difference in that environment that I was in the mountains versus what I came home to was the level of comfort, right? So when I'm out in the mountains, it's like I'm cold the entire time. If I want water, I've got to hike down to the stream to get it. I'm bored out of my mind because my cell phone doesn't work. I'm hungry the whole time because we can only pack in so much food. I go home and things are the absolute opposite, right? Water comes out of the faucet hot automatically. I don't really have to put in any effort for my food. There's tons of food in the pantry. If I'm bored, I've got 70 screens around the house or whatever it is, right? And at the same time, the environment that I lived in out there, just hunting, gathering, basically, was the environment that humans lived in for 2.5 million years. And that is what we are adapted to. And we changed our environment so fast. And this sort of drive that we have as a result of that to be do the next most easy, comfortable thing, it doesn't always serve us in a world where you can hit Uber Eats and get food automatically, where you don't have to exercise to survive or move around. And so it's really just this mismatch. But it was the sobriety that I would say was the catalyst to making those realizations. And then things just sort of fell into a strange sort of domino effect that led to the book.
I bring that up because I feel like that's a, you know, not to make light of anybody else's struggle, but alcoholism is one of those ones we kind of can all identify, especially in others and not ourselves. But we all have our own compulsive actions or tendencies. And I think that's something where there's more empathy given as a listener, in other words. And so I wanted to, kind of find some relatable ground here. But again, I think there's still this like disconnect or what do you mean that running water is a comfort? I've had that my whole life. And I think that's kind of the point though, right?
Yeah. And that would have been my reaction too. So as part of the book, The Comfort Crisis, the overarching narrative of it is I went and spent 33 days in the Arctic. And the point is not that the solution to your life is to go up to the Arctic for a month, but I just wanted to really understand what I was writing about. And sometimes you kind of need to go to the edge to understand the topic. And then you can kind of bring some of the lessons back. And I'll tell you that I go out and I spend a month in the Arctic. It's freezing cold the whole time. Getting water is just this giant effort. There's never enough food. And when I got back from that, the first time hot running water hit my hands, it was like a miracle, right? I mean, I broke out into a grin for half an hour and I was like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. And it's like, when's the last time I had ever thought about or appreciated hot running water, this thing I had had in my life for 3 decades. And never once had I realized what a freaking miracle that is. And if you can realize that everything from hot running water to cars to the fact that you don't have to go hunt down your food every day are a miracle, I think that colors your perception of your life. And it can really be a boon because you realize like, look, I've already won the game being born in whatever, in 1990 or 1980, being alive right now. Like this is the best time to ever be alive. And there's so many things that we used to have to spend so much time and effort. I mean, it's just terrible having to do all these basic things now that we just totally take for granted. So it's like we've covered like the bases. And now we have an opportunity to go, okay, what interesting things can I do now? You don't have to worry about the water, right? We got that. So what kind of cool stuff can I do with my life?
I hear somebody that's an older listener thinking, well, you're calling it like scarcity mentality or scarcity brain. I'm calling it get off my lawn, or we used to have to walk to school uphill both ways. You know, we had it much harder and it made us better for it. I don't think you're disagreeing with them to a certain, you know, to a certain extent. But at the same time, it's like, well, duh, but progress, like technological progress has achieved a certain level of convenience is the word I'm going for here. And yet that convenience arguably doesn't necessarily make us better.
Right. So I kind of like to explain. So when we talk about, you know, a lot of the problems that I highlight in my book, like the fact that we've engineered physical activity out of our lives, that we've engineered kind of hyper palatable food into our lives, that we now spend 12 to 13 hours engaged with digital media, that all comes with side effects. The fact that we spend 93% of our time indoors, I mean, on and on and on. Those all come with problems. At the same time, I will take those problems to the problems that we used to have of not having enough water, all these things, right? So they're good problems to have in the grand scheme of time and space, but they're still problems that we need to address if we want to really kind of like milk this strange moment that we've all been born into that has a lot of opportunity.
Yeah. Let's make sure that we define specifically, like we're talking scarcity brain. Someone says, okay, that's an interesting term. I mean, we've probably already covered it, but let's just make sure we hammer it and lock it in. What do you define the scarcity brain as?
Yeah, I simply define it as the feeling that you never have enough. We're creatures that adapt. We get the thing and we go, oh, great. What else could I get? Right? So we normalize to our circumstances and we're always sort of craving and wanting. And there's good evolutionary reasons for that. In the past, when you didn't have enough food, when food was scarce, when information was scarce, when possessions were scarce, if you were the type of person who was always trying to get more and more and more, that would give you a survival advantage. But now where we live in a world where we can get more and more and more and our survival doesn't depend on it, it can often work against us.
In other words, we have more than enough, but we still want more. And it's because we don't really know that we have enough or more than enough.
Yeah, evolution didn't give us a governor on too much. It cued us to think we never have enough, right? That's a great survival mechanism in a world where there isn't enough, where things are scarce, but it isn't in a world where we do have enough.
The scarcity loop stems from that. Can you define what that means?
Yeah, so I think probably some context is useful. Big picture is you can think about this as the sort of most powerful addictive habit loop. And I started thinking about this because I live in Las Vegas, where there's slot machines everywhere. I mean, they're in grocery stores, they're in gas stations, they're at the airport, and people will sit down at 7 a.m. and they will play for hours and hours and hours. And I look at that and I go, that doesn't make any sense because the house always wins, right? No one ever makes money in the long term on slot machines. So like, why the hell would someone do that? So my job as a journalist, when I go, why the hell would someone do that? I have to go chase down the answer, right? And I end up talking to a slot machine designer and he tells me basically slots work on this three-part mechanism that I call it the scarcity loop. So there's opportunity, unpredictable rewards, and quick repeatability. So with slot machines, you have an opportunity to win money. The rewards are unpredictable, meaning that you know if you keep playing and playing, you're going to win at some point, but you don't know how much and you don't know when it's going to happen. And then quick repeatability, you can immediately repeat a game. So the average slot player plays 900 games in an hour. That's more than we blink. So I learn about this and the guy kind of tells me, yeah, this thing isn't just in slot machines though. I mean, it's in a lot of things today. And you start to look at this three-part loop and it's what makes social media work. It's been put in personal finance apps that have really grabbed a lot of users. It's in dating apps. It's in sports betting. Really anything with unpredictable rewards that people tend to get hooked on is driven by this loop. And it's really kind of the foundation of addictive behavior.
I remember the one time I landed in Vegas on a flight and took a look to the left or the right to try and find a bathroom. And before I even could find a bathroom, I found a slot machine. So
yeah, this town wasn't built on winners. They're there for a reason.
Yes. Well, as you say, the house always wins, and we've all heard that. And yet we kind of don't realize that we're carrying around in our pocket a slot machine all day, every day.
Totally. That's exactly what makes social media work. So opportunity, you have an opportunity to either get likes and comments, and that feels good, but you don't know when you're going to get them. You don't know how many you're going to get. You could get a ton and go viral and, oh my God, this is the most amazing thing that ever happened to me. Or it could be two likes or a comment that says, yeah, you look ugly, or whatever it is, right? And then it's like, oh man, that sucks. And then you check and recheck that phone all day. Or it could be piece of content, right? Swiping through infinite scroll, looking for that piece of content that's going to be like, make you laugh, make you upset, make you outraged about something. And you just keep repeating and repeating and repeating.
Still searching for a great candidate for your company? Don't search, just match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch that busy work. Instead, use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. I wish I had Indeed when I was in the hiring process in roles in the past, because it is a slow, arduous headache of a process to find the right people. Or, at least it used to be, join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to find and hire great talent fast. In fact, in the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to Indeed data worldwide. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/to-do list. Just go to Indeed.com/to-do list right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/to-do list. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
I believe the term is like losses disguised as wins. So even when we don't get the satisfaction from, oh my gosh, my post went viral in my little social circles, a lot of people liked it, commented, whatever, it's the other direction where it's like, well, since we in theory don't have any more real problems, we're going to go looking for them. And anything anybody can say to, I hate this word, but I'm going to use it, trigger us. We decide to be triggered by things.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And losses disguised as wins is language developed by casinos. So one of the things that really made slot machines take off is that they weren't popular until the 1980s. No one really played them. And then in the 1980s, this guy named Cy Red, he came in and he really took this scarcity loop and tweaked it and figured out the perfect way to get people to play more longer. And one of the keys to that was losses disguised as wins, which is when you play a slot machine, let's say you're betting a dollar, you might win, quote unquote, 50 cents. So when you win 50 cents, the machine is going to go ballistic. It's going to be like a party, like, oh, this is great. You won. Now you really lost 50 cents. But when neuroscientists will do scans on people playing, they find that people in their brain, they register losses disguised as wins, similarly to wins. And so they compel people to repeat longer and longer and longer because you're still getting a reward, even though you're losing more slowly, really.
It's the frog boiling in the pot. Kind of the slow boiling of the frog. In other words, he doesn't notice it. It's just like, ah, this is comfortable. It's a hot tub. And then he's dead.
Exactly. So for example, slot machines before 1980, I think they would only have anything happen positively. I think it was about 6% of the time. And once this guy came in and really tweaked how you can get these losses disguised as wins up, something good would happen 45% of the time. But it was like the slow burn. But people, even though they would spend more time on the machine, they would play more money. They tended to bet more money over time. So instead of you lose your $10 in 3 minutes, which that sucks, that's really boring, I'm not ever going to do that again, you would lose your, say, $20 in 20 minutes or 30 minutes or whatever. And you're like, oh, that had some highs, some lows. That was kind of action packed. And you might have some swings, but eventually you just bottom out. And then you're more likely to come back and play the machine.
I'm a huge fan of the movie, and recently, for that matter, Rounders. And because I used to play, we had a regular game. We didn't really bet for real money. It was more we'd put in a small amount and we'd buy our chips. And then at the end of the night, you know, somebody'd walk away with $25, whatever. Not that big of a deal. But during that movie, Rounders, one of the phrases you hear a lot is grinding it out. And what you were just describing makes me think of that, where you've got somebody who goes in and then they sit there for hours on end. And it's all about this, air quotes, strategy of playing the cards when you have them and playing well even when you don't, and so on. And it's the ups and the downs. And I just couldn't help but think of that as you were describing it with slot machines.
Yeah, totally. And so what makes the slot machines interesting is that there's more of like the unpredictable rewards and unpredictable feedback embedded in that. And so, and also the speed. So I think that the quick repeatability of the scarcity loop becomes really important in explaining a lot of sort of, I guess you would call it maybe habit forming technology today, where the faster you can do a behavior, the more likely you are to do the behavior. So in the case of slot machines, when they got rid of the handles, which took a couple seconds to pull, and switched them over to spin buttons, you saw the number of games increase from about 400 an hour to 900 an hour. And then you apply that same logic to, I mean, think if you were on whatever your social media platform of choice is, say Instagram or Twitter, if you could look at, say, 10 posts and then you had to click onto a next page button to see the next 10, how much time do you think you'd spend on social media compared to if it's infinite scroll?
Oh, it's way less, because you've got to actually consciously click to go to the next versus just kind of scroll. And it's similar yet different if you're on a that's why I try to do, if I'm going to do social, I try to do it on a desktop, because one, it's further from my face, most likely, with an actual monitor or laptop screen, which is still bigger, better, farther away. Two, it's less tactile, so it's less me interacting with digital content by swiping physically and rewiring my brain to feel like it's something that I'm holding in my hand and playing with manipulatively, with physical touch. But yeah, that psychological click is a decision pivot point. Whereas if you just don't kind of give them that, and it's just kind of, again, the frog in the pot, you just keep going.
Yeah, exactly. And there's actually, there's an app that is called ClearSpace that I think is really great. You choose which apps you want to apply it to, and it basically inserts a pause and it slows down that quick repeatability. Because a lot of times people will, you know, you're in a line, people pull out their phone, they load some app reflexively, and then they just kind of dive in. But if it inserts this pause, so it goes, are you sure you want to use this app? And you go, yes. And then it goes, okay, well, let's take a breather for 10 seconds. You breathe in, you breathe out, shows you a nice quote about, you know, how to live a life in your time and attention. And then you have to choose, how long am I going to spend in this app? 5 minutes, 10 minutes. So that way you can only get sucked in for so long, right? So just by forcing intentionality, it just plummets people's screen time and slowing down that quick repeatability.
Very cool. I'm going to make sure to link up to that in the show notes for sure, because I had not heard of that before. I know that you, in the writing process and the research process for Scarcity Brain, you talked to a lot of different people all over the world. What were some of the maybe most surprising findings that you came across?
I think that I had some interesting findings around food and the food system. So the reason that I got interested in this is when you look at how people in developed countries die, the number one killer worldwide is by far cardiovascular disease. So heart disease, strokes, and we totally ignore it. Like, you look at what people worry about, it is not heart disease. You look at what the media covers, it is not heart disease. And so I'd always thought that was a really fascinating mismatch. And then I come up on this study that studied this tribe called the Chimane. They live in the Bolivian Amazon. And it found that they have the healthiest hearts ever recorded. So they basically don't die of heart disease, and they can live relatively long lives. And so I decided I got to go see this for myself. So I fly from Vegas to, I think I had to fly to LA and then to like Colombia, then to La Paz. And then I had to take this 12-hour drive down these cliffy dirt roads and then hop in this canoe and go 6-7 hours up this feeder river of the Amazon. And, you know, we pull up to a bank and it's like, well, it's looked the exact same for the last 6 hours. Are you sure we're here? And the boat guys, yeah, we're here. So we get out and yeah, I lived with this tribe for a handful of days and just kind of observed them and try to figure out what's going on. And it seems to mostly go back to what they eat. So what they eat at some point in the day, I like to say, is that is going to offend some fad diet we've had in the last 30 years. So it's not low carb. It's not low fat. It's got meat in it. It has corn. I mean, it's got a little bit of wheat. So the one commonality that it has, though, is that all the foods are just one ingredient, right? So they're eating plantains, they're eating potatoes, they're eating corn, they're eating fish that they pull out of the river themselves, they're eating meat that they hunt, they're eating things like avocado. So every food has just one ingredient. They eat a lot of rice too. And when I tried to figure out, okay, well, why, how would that factor in, right? And it's that simply by eating those types of foods, people tend to eat less. And it goes back a lot of it to that quick repeatability part. So when I talked to a guy who's an executive for a junk food company, he said, if you want to get a junk food to sell, it's got to have three V's. It's got to have value. It's got to have variety and it's got to have velocity. So it's got to be cheap. There's got to be a ton of different types of it. We can't just have one Dorito. We need 79 different kinds of Doritos.
Yes.
And it's got to be fast to eat. The speed is the really important thing. So when you look at how much people eat, if they're eating foods that are unprocessed, just have one ingredient versus foods that are highly processed, people who eat highly processed foods eat about 500 more calories a day. And the whole reason for that is because those foods are simply much faster to eat. So you've eaten more before you've filled up. And so it very much just goes back to that. I just found that like a very usable thing. Like, okay, most of the foods I eat should just have one ingredient. They should be rather simple. That's not to say like, don't ever eat processed food. Of course not. It's like, I don't want to live in a world where I can't eat, you know, whatever 80th new Dorito they just released. But I think it needs to be built on a foundation of eating rather simple foods that humans have for thousands and thousands of years.
Well, since we're talking kind of in a prescriptive manner with that, when it comes to one of the main things we've talked about here, food, and I would say it's basically you're choosing, you're conscious and you're choosing actions based on awareness. Is there any other aspect of food that we should have more conscious effort or conscious action around?
Yeah, I can't remember if this book gets into this, but this is because you brought up the term awareness. I think because of the way food is processed today, we often don't know what a serving size is. You know, so a lot of people will go, okay, I have this goal. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a food goal. That's the example we'll use. Could be any goal. I have this goal. So the goal is point B. And they go, okay, I'm going to go get to point B. The problem is that they haven't found point A, right? So it's kind of like you call me and you're like, hey, I need to get to the Las Vegas Strip. What do I need to know? Okay, well, where the hell are you? Right? Because if I tell you to go west and you're already west, like you're just getting lost. So people don't know where point A is. And in finding point A, that takes observation. That takes figuring out where you're at now. As you find point A, you start to observe your own behaviors. Your behaviors start to change. This is what's called the observer effect. And it's a nuisance to scientists because, say, if scientists are studying worker productivity, the minute they start watching the workers and go, okay, how productive are the workers? What do you think the workers do?
Appear more productive. You know you're being watched.
They work harder.
Yeah.
Right? And so this is something that you can actually use on yourself. So we'll go back to the example of food. It's like if you go, okay, I want to lose weight. I'm going to have to eat differently. Well, what do you eat now? How do you really know that, right? So just taking some basic measuring, you'll start to learn things like, and I did this on myself. Oh, what I thought was one serving of peanut butter is actually like 4 servings of peanut butter and 800 calories, like more calories than a number 5 at McDonald's or whatever. And so that simple act of awareness going, oh, I'm starting to figure out where point A is. Your behavior starts to shift and just simply get you closer to point B without having to undertake these drastic, drastic measures, right? Because when people go point B, they're like, I'm going to do all this crazy stuff to get there. And it's like, no, you might have to just be more aware of what you're already doing and make small tweaks that are going to be much more sustainable in the long run.
Okay, so let's do this with 2 other things that I kind of remember from this conversation so far. Point A and point B, Well, let's just talk point A. Let's talk point A for technology for a second, but also let's talk physical activity. Those are the two other ones I was kind of thinking of.
Okay. So technology, when you look at why people use their cell phones, only 10% of the time it's because of an alert. You got a text, a thing, the New York Times popped up and told you that the world is ending again today, whatever it might be, right? And 90% of it is because we feel some sort of internal discomfort. Oftentimes it is boredom. Oftentimes it is stress. And so I think if you can start to observe, whenever you pull out your phone, go, okay, I'm just going to write down why. When did I pull it out? What am I feeling right now? It's going to be a pain for like 2 days, but you're going to start to go, oh, I pull out my phone around this time. And this also happens to be the time that, I don't know, I get emails from my boss and that stresses me out. Or from 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock when work sort of slows down and I'm bored. So then you can start to go, okay, well, if I'm trying to solve the boredom problem, now I can start to go, all right, what else could I do with this boredom? What things could I do that are more productive? So building that simple awareness. And then what was the other example?
Physical activity. The 95% of the day indoors versus engineered physical activity out of our lives. What does a point A look like with that?
Yeah, I think going, okay, instead of saying, you know, how can I do more physical activity, goes, okay, well, why do I sit in the first place? What's leading me to sit, right? And it could be, well, because I'm taking office calls. And you start to go, okay, so I have to do this call. Do I actually have to take the call in my office though? What if I just paced around the house as I took the call, right? Or it's the end of a day and you go, well, I planned to work out, but I'm sitting instead. And it goes, well, if your days are really complex and stressing, like maybe you need to find a different place to try and do the exercise. So starting with the why do I sit in the first place can be useful.
Okay. So let's talk maybe like those are point A's and they start to lead to a point B, but since you know that, what are some of those like micro actions we can then you do? I know, for example, I know one of them with like technology that I already talked about a little bit was desktop and laptop versus, and laptop's kind of a middle ground, I guess, but in other words,
mobile
versus other, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think I go back in the example of tech, I go back to that tool, ClearSpace. I think that your example is great too. I try and do the same with Instagram and just check it on my laptop, desktop. And ClearSpace also has a Chrome app, which I've installed because then I noticed that I was just starting to get onto Twitter on my laptop way too often. So you just kind of have to like, it's that awareness and then putting in tools that sort of stop that. With physical activity, I think one thing I would say is that, so a study that really changed my thinking about all things, but physical activity in particular, is that it found 2% of people take the stairs when there's an escalator available. And so this tells us that we are wired to do the next easiest, most comfortable thing, even though 100% of people know that if you take the stairs, you're going to get a better long-term return on your health and wellness. And by the way, it's not going to require doing really anything that different in your life. You got to get to the second floor and you have a choice. You can do the thing that's going to make you feel more comfortable in the short term that doesn't give you any long-term benefits. It might even hurt your health in the long term. Or you can go, you know what? I'm going to embrace this, whatever it is, 5 second stair climb, 10 second stair climb. And that's going to give me a longer term return. And people will say, well, that's not enough. Just climbing the stairs a few times a day. There's actually a study that found that people who climbed stairs for 3 minutes, 3 times a week, they had a 30% lower risk of all-cause mortality. So there you go. Like this stuff really adds up, especially if you're not doing much, doing anything at all. If you're sedentary, is like, it's huge. And of course, the larger message is not about the stairs. It's a metaphor for when you have the opportunity to do something that's going to be a little more physically effortful and give you a longer term benefit. I mean, you got to take that. Like, just learn to take that. Take the 2% mindset. So my newsletter is called the 2% newsletter for this reason.
You beat me to it. I was like ready to mention it.
Yeah, it's at you can find it on, you can sign up for it on my website, eastermichael.com, or we have a home site for it that is twopct.com. But it gets into, there's a whole 2% manifesto I wrote that gives all these different examples of this and kind of helps people understand the idea in a fun way.
Yeah. Any recent entries into the newsletter that you think people would be really interested in light of this conversation?
Yeah, there was one that looked at why people use phones in the first place. If actually probably the best entry point would just story that I've pinned on the site is best of 2%. And so it has a bunch of different links that people can flow into and see whatever topic they want, whether it's mindset or physical activity or nutrition or psychology. There's a lot of different stuff. So
perfect. Well, I'm going to link up to 2%, the newsletter, as well as I'll go ahead and throw the link for Comfort Crisis, but also obviously Scarcity Brain in the links for the show notes for this episode. But I want to give you kind of like a wrap up moment here to kind of just kind of land the plane. How do you think we should be shifting our perspective? I mentioned the word awareness and self-awareness earlier, which obviously play into it, but how would you kind of close up and push people towards awareness and action through the perspective of possibility?
Yeah, the idea of a perspective of possibility is interesting and definitely something I think a lot about. So what I'll say is that after I spent a month in the Arctic, and my work has taken me to a lot of really interesting, but also trying places. And I found people in conflict zones in the middle of the jungle in countries that are some of the least developed on Earth that are seemingly more happy and more satisfied with what I find in my subdivision here in Las Vegas, right? And so I think that really everything kind of starts in your mindset. And I do think that the 2% mindset can be a good way to sort of help people push back and build a little bit of resilience, I would say. And I found that people are way more capable than they realize. And I think there are good evolutionary reasons why people are underconfident, but overly capable, for sure. And I find that when people get into a spot, we always think, I'm not going to be able to do that big thing. I can't do it. I'm not going to be able to figure it out. And the only way you're going to figure that out is if you throw yourself into that environment and just try. What's the worst that can happen? And it's 2024. What's the worst that can happen? You're probably not going to die if it's a business thing, right? Like, you're going to be fine. And by not being willing to throw yourself into the proverbial fire, if you will, you're never going to get meddled. You're never going to really realize what you're capable of. And once you do that, it changes how you see yourself moving forward in the future. And that allows you to, I think, accomplish more.
That's a great landing point right there. I think that we are poised to make some pretty big changes here. So Michael, it's been great talking with you. Again, like I said, I'll link up to all the things, the app, the books, the newsletter, all that in the show notes for this episode. Thank you so much for being here. And I can't wait to see what you do next in terms of the next book, although I'm sure me and everybody else will be following along with the newsletter as you go.
Yeah, right on. Well, I really appreciate you having me on, man. This was a really fun conversation.
Well, that's another podcast crossed off your listening to-do list. I hope that you enjoyed this conversation with Michael Easter, and I hope that you got something out of this conversation enough to jump over to his 2% newsletter. I've been looking at it myself and subscribed, and it's very interesting. There's a lot of food for thought there. And on top of that, definitely grabbing and going through the Comfort Crisis and Scarcity Brain books. I've linked up to those both in the show notes for this episode, which you can find at beyondthetodolist.com. If you found this episode helpful, I'd love for you to do one thing, and that is share this show. Share it on social media, send it out there into the world, let others know about this show. Think of that one person that you know needs to hear it and share it with them. You probably have somebody in mind as you were listening. Thank you so much for sharing. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next episode.